Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. I want to thank you. Guys, it's June 1st. What a day. Nice sunny day in Southern California. I hope everybody is having a smooth day, smooth Friday, wherever you are on this planet called Earth. I think it's called Earth. I do have one quick special announcement before I get on my show, and I'm going to go through a lot of material today. This is actually going to be a sort of a two-parter, by the way. And it's specifically about the Middle Eastern history. Today I'll just go the dynamics of it. But before I do have one special announcement for those living in the Los Angeles area. I will be conducting jointly with Sharon Joseph, a special class, a weekly class, which is being starting next week on June 7th. That's a Thursday. At 7:30 in Calabasas, California. We will be going through various meditations, Kabbalah, angels, healings, karma, past lives, manifestations, going out of body. We're going to have multitude of classes. The cost is only $20 per week. Again, this class will be is information between myself, Andrew Fetter, and Sharon Joseph, and she's an esteemed channeler herself. For further information as to where and the update on it, you can make contact at 818-912-2535, or you might email directly to Sharon Nikta. Email address is Sharon, Sharon, Itka, at sbcglobal.net. Of course, that's I listed it on my website, so you can, if you lost that or whatever, you can always go back and check it out. Please, those out there, come on. This is very limited. We're only going to have limited spacing, so it's sort of first-come, first-served reservations. Again, I want to thank those who do come next week. I look forward to doing this particular class. It's sort of a reminder of how I was engaged with my past teacher, Jade St. Clair, and I will dedicate those classes for her. Anyway, check that out. It is starting up next Thursday, and I look forward to it. Now, I'm knowing that a lot of people are going to ask have an affinity for the Middle East and things like that. I have lived in Israel from 80 to 86. I was there from 77 to 78. So living approximately a quadrant of about 7 years. In fact, the first time I ever even stepped in Jerusalem was actually when Sadat literally stepped foot on Jerusalem. Made that famous speech in the Knesset. So I guess I do have an affinity, but I also have a really in-depth knowledge of that area, in particular of the Arabs, called Palestinians, on the West Bank, as I was very much involved. I still do have a lot of friends in the West Bank, in areas from Tukaram and in those surrounding areas. And even Israeli Arabs, like Kfar Qara. So I have a very much in-depth knowledge of seeing what was really said behind doors and in front of doors, which I will elaborate. Now, this show, I decided I want to just give the straight-up facts, the real history, with no PC. I know people are going to get really weirded out when I tell them this, but this is the real history of what happened. It's not make-believe, and you're going to see why the situation has occurred the way it is. You'll understand not just within the Israeli-Palestinian issues, but this is why a lot of things, situations have occurred into the Middle East from Iraq even to Lebanon. You'll have an understanding, maybe you have a better understanding how things were created and partitioned, cut off. It's not so much drastic as even the situation that actually happened between India and Pakistan, when actually Pakistan and India, by the way, was one country until it was partitioned. So, and they had the same situation. So it's all been about religion. It's never really been all over land. But the Middle East is very much formable because of the one three-letter word, which is called oil. Now, I'm going to go back in history. Now, this is going to be part one of this show. This show, I'm just laying down the facts, going through every item I could possibly go through, trying to coordinate in a, without going off tangent. I actually had to really keep myself in line here. And next week's show, then I'm going to get to the spiritual reality of how the souls there can actually achieve, reverse their karma and reverse things and change the dynamics. Because literally, the Middle East is the epitome of what everything is wrong about humanity. It's literally the magnifying glass. I'm just telling you. That's another reason why I'm so focused on that. What happens, because that literally tells, literally you don't need to look anywhere else, but you can look at the Middle East and you can tell what's messed up with humanity. And I look at humanity not as a individually, but as a collective, because we are literally one consciousness. And I'm going to get into that next week. Now, when most people think of the Middle East, the first thing that pops in their mind is the Israeli Arab conflict or Israeli Palestinian issues. That is probably correct, but not correct. And it does have one focus, because that's everybody's focus on that point. But in real terms, it's so ironic, because if you look at Israel, the size of it, how big that area is and the amount of population there, you couldn't even make a sliver of it, even in the world of dynamics. Yet it gets 50% of the news, literally, think about it. 50% of international news is focused on that area. You'd wonder why. I mean, for such a small population, for small things. I mean, you have more killings between Los Angeles and San Diego, more things going on. It's the same amount of area. In fact, if you stretch it from Los Angeles to San Diego, that's literally Israel. So it's really a small country, if you think about it. And including the West Bank, I mean, it's ridiculously little. So you're talking a gamut of about 7 million people. That's a city. That's a major city, like Los Angeles is even bigger than that. So that tells you that things sometimes are hyperbole and exaggerated in the Middle East for everybody's own, you know, their own little ways of looking things. And most of it has to do with religion or lack of. Religion, or it's just simple hatred. Now, most and are many are quite ignorant of history, or choose to revise their own facts, which I've seen so recently. People pick and choose, and they make opinions, and they turn those opinions into facts when they're not reality or facts, and it's to fit their own opinions or to fit their own opinions. Now, I'm going to go into some serious, straight up facts. Jews are, in fact, a people. It's not just a religion. DNA confirms this as their haplotypes being having X and J haplotypes. And they also have the common Y chromosome amongst males, who have to be the Kohanim, which are the priesthood. And this is found whether they have lived in Poland, Russia, Morocco, Yemen, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Germany. Get the drift? So they have a common DNA. They are actually a people. This is a physical fact. A physical fact. It's not just because they believe something. This is what's different. They're not just, oh, I believe in something, therefore that's what I am. It's more of a physical fact. Now, what does Jew mean? Jew mean doesn't mean you believe in Judaism, literally. I hate to tell you. Jew literally means you are from Judea. That's your origin. Apologize. So I'm making a phone call in the middle of the show. So that was what the word Jew means. from Judea. There was a division between literally two kingdoms at in about 900 BCE between the of Israel. And that was out of dislodging a fight, I guess, amongst brothers, if you want to call them that. And later became two kingships. One kingdom was in the north, was called Israel, which condensed mainly about the ten tribes, known as the ten lost tribes of Israel. And the remainder was Judea, which is the south, which composed mainly of the tribe Judah, Levi, and the Kohens, and also, I'm sorry, the Benjamin tribe. The ten other tribes of Israel were basically up in the north. Dan tribe, people forget that, was in the south, had moved their tribe up north because at the time, for so many years, in the times of King David, they were constantly being attacked by the then Philistines. And of course, the Philistines disappeared and blah, 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 by the time it was King Solomon, but the tribe of Dan just basically remained up north. In fact, there's an area up northern Israel called Tel Dan, and that's how they got their name. Anyway, Assyria now conquered, of course, the kingdom of Israel, but was unsuccessful against conquering Judea. And the Babylonians, some 100 years later, did that, of course. And the people from the kingdom of Judea were called from henceforth Jews. Yes. So Assyria and Babylonians are essentially the ones who started this, the name, the understanding that they are all Jews, are from Judea. That's where this name came from both the Babylonians and Assyrians. When Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon, they called that area, they continued to call that area Judea. So it was Judea back then under Babylonians. It was Judea by the Syrians, and it was still called Judea by Cyrus the Great and under the Persians. And the Jews were, even from where they were called Jews. Even Alexander the Great called them Jews. The Romans called them Jews. Where are they from? Judea. Now, during the Roman era time, there was literally, this is an actual fact, 10% of the population of the Roman Empire was actually Jews, and Jews didn't live just in Judea at that time. They had lived in, actually a lot had lived in Alexandria, and that was under the premise because they were under good terms under the ruling of Alexander the Great initially, and in course of time they end up living in Alexandria. There was a heavy population. And they also had scattered in areas eventually into the Roman Peninsula and also within areas, certain areas in Greece, particularly in Cyprus and those areas, and henceforth. So there was a scattered amount of Jews in other areas within Europe at that time. When Romans, like I said, called them even Jews. And even when they extinguished the second... the Judea, basically, by the extinguishing of the second Jewish revolt and this destroying their ancient temple, they still referred to them as Jews. Like I said, many Jews scattered after the fall of Jerusalem, but there was always a major presence of Jewish presence there in Judea or Israel. That is a fact. You can look through records and everything. There was always a major, major presence. Jerusalem has always been held a significant Jewish population. There have been times when they had held a majority. Didn't matter who ruled it, whether it's Byzantine, Roman, Muslim, Christian, Crusader, there was always a significant amount of Jews living in Jerusalem. Now, we're going to come to... So people, when they think of, they like scattered in the wind, there was never any Jews living in Israel, that's wrong. There have always been Jews living in that area. That's a fact. Even since that time, and I'll go through it, but there's been many migrations of Jews coming back to live there, and there's reason for that migration is because of Zionism. People have a misunderstanding even with Zionism. They constantly think of Zionism started in the 1800s by a guy named Theodore Herzl. No, wrong. Zionism did not start by a guy named Theodore Herzl or anybody. It did not come from Europe. It was not something Illuminati planned. It was nothing of the course. It was not some made-up thing that just came out of nowhere. Zion comes from the word Zion, which is Har Zion, which is where the Mount Temple is, the Temple Mount. Zion, because it's Mount Zion. You can read it in the Bible over and over. It's all over the place, from Isaiah to Jeremiah, what they call Har Zion, Mount of Zion. And Zionism has been held within Jews since the days under Babylon. That was where Zionism initiated, when their first significant population of Jerusalem was carted off from that area. It did not come into being somehow in the 1800s. It has always been there. It's always been engraved within the dogmas of Judaism and the dogmas of their political beliefs and nationality amongst Jews. It's been there for more than 2,000 years. In fact, if you, in any Seder, you'll look on their book that they read on their Passover, and this has been going on for more than 2,000 years, by the way, next year in Jerusalem. It's always been there. Next year in Jerusalem. That means what they're talking about. There's a famous quote. This is started in the back in the days of when Babylon, and this is when Zionism started, was famous, and I'm quoting you in English, of course. I know from in Hebrew, but it says, "If I ever forget old Jerusalem, may I cut off my right arm." That was said well over 2,300 years ago, 2,400 years ago. So that was actually the birth of Zionism. There was no Theodore Herzl. There was no somebody in Europe at that time. there was no Germany even. There wasn't a Rome. That's when Zionism started. And it's been always embedded in their own religious dogmas and beliefs. There's no denial. This is actual fact. Now, there are a certain group of misinformities now, and I'll get to how Zionism of today, what you see, the organization initiated out of through Europe, but that was out of a organized, first time being organized, as opposed, you know, you have a belief, but it was never like a movement. It's like we can all believe in the same thing, but it was never really organized. You know, the one thing that was amazing, Jews were always scattered, and they weren't really the most organized. They never organized themselves together. That came about in the 1800s, which I'll get into. So it's been in there, embedded with them. Now you'll hear some very small, and I'm saying like micro sliver, micro of Hasids. Hasids are very Orthodox Jews, and they call themselves Nuturi Carter. And they believe in a future Israel needs to come in hand by the hand of God, and that this state, future Jewish state, in their eyes, has to be a very strict Orthodox state, almost like a Taliban, Jewish Taliban version. And meaning also in their eyes that everybody has to literally be Jewish too. So they're very much, that's those guys who you see who go to Iran and they don't like Israel, because Israel to them, today's Israel, is a blemish in their eye, because they'd say, they use the word called in Hebrew, Poshe Yisrael, criminal of Israel, because they don't follow the orthodoxy. They are secular. They don't care, you know. They would be the one. They'd be like Iran, stoning gays and beating up, stoning women if they're and things like that. And if you drive on the Sabbath, they're the ones who throw stones if you're driving through the streets on the Sabbath. That's how crazy those people are. That's literally them. Okay, they're the, I call them Jewish Taliban. I'm telling you straight up. If they had their way, it'd be not that far off of it. That's why I believe in, and I'll get into next week's show about the spiritual realities and what I believe in, how to fix things and what the realities, things how to come to being in that area, not just in Israel, but all throughout the Middle East. But again, these very people are very few ones, and in fact, you probably have seen them in Iran in recent years and slandering Israel and blah, blah, blah. Now, Zionism has always been there. It was just in the 1800s in Europe, it was organized as a central movement as opposed to scattering migrations. It is a fact that Jews, like I said, have been consistently migrating back to Israel. And even go to Tzfat, and there's the area where, in fact, famous Kabbalists who live there, Rav Isaac Luria, known as the Ari, for example, go to Tzfat. It's a city near Sea of Galilee, and there's a huge presence of Jews that were there for more than, God, 1300s, okay? 1400s, way back, or I think it was 1200s. There's always been a consistent amount of Jews living there. There's Rambam, Muhammadis, everybody should maybe know them. He migrated there back, I think, believe it was the 1400s or so. There has always been extreme large presence. There's always been Jews there. There always has been. There's always been a large presence. This is a fact, period. Now, here's the other fact. And I'm going to get into the facts of what Palestine and Palestinians. First of all, Palestine, first of all, comes the word from Philistine. And it was made up by the, I'll get into it, made up by the Romans. What people think of Palestine. First, Philistines are the people of Philistines who you heard there, Samson, and, you know, and there was following them, and there's, of course, Goliath with David. The Philistines were called, they were actually originally from the area from Greece. They were called the basically Palestinian, or Philistine means literally invader, which I'll read and get into. They're from outside. So it's sort of weird context to use that name, or is it maybe ironic? But basically, let's look at what the Arab people, commonly known as Palestinians today, what their true identity and what they're really, true origin is. Instead of these mythical surroundings of understandings where they're assumed to be from or where they're clinging to, and a lot of nonsense, there's been ample proof and knowledge, and if you're objective and neutral enough, based upon historical and archaeological evidence, and in other documents, including Arab sources and quotations and statements by very well-known Islamic personalities, it is a fact. These are the facts. There are some modern myths, and even more exactly lies, even portrayed in mass media, if not brought into a ridiculous thing. For example, whenever the people speak of the Temple Mount or Jerusalem are mentioned, it is marked as a third holy place for Muslim, which in fact it never is. It is in reality the first holy place for Jews. Now, this sounds sort of biased, but in reality, that's what it is. And I'm going to go through the origins of two situations. First, the myths and facts concerning the origin and identity of the so-called Palestinians, and the myths and facts regarding Jerusalem and the land of Israel. And then I'm going to continue on through the rest of it, and I'll go back to the origins of the conflicts of that area. Now, the Palestinians literally are the newest peoples on the face of this planet, on Earth. If you look in history, the Palestinian identity is called, are the newest people. Start in 1900s. In fact, originally Palestinians, by the way, and you can look this up, Arabs living in Israel there weren't called Palestinians, they're called Arabs. It was under the Palestine Mandate. Jews living there were called Palestinians. That was what's funny about this. The irony is Jews living in the 1920s when the British took control of the mandate. In fact, the British called the Jews living there Palestinians, and the Arabs living there Arabs. This is a really unique phenomenon. There is a famous, a guy named Walid Shobat. He's a former head of the PLO, and he even acknowledged the lie, why he was finding the real truth behind the lie. Why was that? On June 4th, 1967, I was a Jordanian, and overnight I became a Palestinian. Fact. We did not particularly mind Jordanian rule. These are his quotes. the teaching and of the destruction of Israel was a definite part of the curriculum. But we considered ourselves Jordanian until the Jews returned to Jerusalem. Then all of a sudden, we were all Palestinians. They removed the star from the Jordanian flag, and all at once, we had a Palestinian flag. Look at the Jordanian flag and the Palestinian flag. Take off that little star, and that's all it is. Just get my drift. When I finally realized the myths I was taught, it was my duty as a righteous person to speak out. This is coming from a head official from the PLO. I mean, this is the declaration of a Palestinian who had significant, and this is his telling of how it is. And there is indeed, there's no such thing as a Palestinian people, Palestinian culture, Palestinian language. Like the Arabic spoken in there, and I can tell you for firsthand, is speaking with a Syrian dialect. And you go to Gaza area, they speak with an Egyptian dialect. There has never been any Palestinian state, nor Palestinian archaeological find, nor coinage. There has never been such a thing as Palestinians or Palestinian people with an Arab. They are basically an Arab culture, Arab language, Arab history. They have their own Arab states from which they came into the land of Israel, majority of them from Syria. And about one century ago, to contrast the immigration of the Jewish immigrations, that is actually a historical fact, truth. They were Jordanians, most recent, which is another, by the way, British invention. There was no such thing as Jordanians. That was actually created. That's another thing. And after the Six-Day War, in which Israel defeated 9 Arab states, took the possession of Judea, Eric, and Samaria, known as the West Bank. Suddenly, the Arab dwellers living therein became somehow Palestinian, and somehow, under out of nowhere, kind of archaeological miracle, discovered that they were really Palestinians. Like something just happened. Of course, these people have a new identity to build themselves a history. That's, everybody has a right to new self-determination, new things, that's how they see fit. But not to steal another's or try to erase another's history and make them victims and call them thieves, when in reality it was not. Therefore, the Palestinian leaders have consistently claimed 2 contrary linkages for themselves from ancient peoples that inhabit the land. They call themselves Canaanites and Philistines. Now, let's look at what both. First, they will say that, oh, you know what? We're linked to the Canaanites. We have Canaanite blood. In fact, most of them are not Canaanite blood. Majority have a mixture between what we call Edomites and Arab blood. Edomites are the lineage of Esau, and they dwelled in mainly Syria area. That's where the Syrian population is. Most of the Syrians are Edomites, or Edomites, E-D-M-O-I-T-S, and that's actually a fact. The Canaanites historically acknowledged as the first inhabitants of Israel, land of Israel. For the, of course, the ancient Hebrews settled there. And this is actually a fact why it was called Canaan, not Palestine. Palestine, a Roman invention, the name was seen later. They're composed of several different tribes, and they were distinguished in 2 main groups. There was the coastal Canaanites, southern, or the southern ones were also the mountain Canaanites. The northern Canaanites settled along the Mediterranean from the southeastern side of the Gulf of Exodorum to the proximities of the Gulf of Haifa. Their main cities, Etzur, Sidon, Gebel, Arvad, or Gid, and are better known by their Greek names as the Phoenicians. But they call themselves Kahana. So the northern Canaanites lived as Phoenicians. And that actually went all the way from, you would say, near Haifa and Haria into modern-day Lebanon. That was mainly Phoenicians. Of course, eventually they continued moving forth northern. Anyway, they did not form any unified kingdom, but were well-organized self-city rules. They basically had city kingships. Even to the days of when Alexander fought the famous fight in Tyre, that was a Phoenician city, basically. Their language was adopted from their neighbors, from the Semitic neighbors, the Arameans, which was closely related to Hebrew, not to Arabic. Phoenicians and Israel did not need interpreters to understand each other. They are very much similar language. They follow the same destiny of ancient Israel, but they too fell under the Assyrian rule and were pretty much scattered. Then it was Babylon and Persian, Macedonian, Seleucian, Greek, Roman. Throughout their history, the Phoenicians intermarried with different, and they dwelled in their land mainly with Greeks and Armenians. During the Islamic expansion, they were Arabized, yet never completely assimilated. Their present-day state is called Lebanon. Ironically, regards that Arab country as a label, but the Lebanese people really reject that. Unlike the Arab states, Lebanon has a Western democratic self-government, a Lebanese republic. They actually have more of a, the majority, Lebanon is an enclave actually carved out of the Syrian mandate, which I'll explain later, by the French, to incorporate, because the country was literally 80% Christian at that time. It was set aside as a partition, and the people there are very much physically and distinguished from their counterparts. The only term Arabic mentioned in the Lebanese constitution refers to the official language of the state, but they are the Lebanese people as opposed to the Arabs. So-called Palestinians are not Lebanese, although some of them are from Syria occupied. Therefore, they are not Phoenicians or Canaanites. Actually, in Lebanon, they are refugees, not identified as a local people. So you see, that was the northern Canaanites. Now, the southern Canaanites dwell mainly along the Golan, along both sides of the Ardennes, which is the Jordan River, Mediterranean coast, from the Gulf of Paifa, Joppa, the biblical Canaan that we hear of. They were composed of various tribes, different stocks, properly known. Besides the proper Canaanites, the Phoenicians, there was Amorites, and then there was Hittites and Hurrian peoples, and the Horites, and all of them were sort of assimilated in the Aramean Canaan extent. They never constituted a unified or organized state, but yet had tribal alliances. When the Hebrews first arrived in Canaan, and they shared the same common land but did not intermarry. This is quite separate. Abraham's family did. Abraham's family to marry the Canaanites was like, oh my God. There's of course some, 11 of the 12 sons of Jacob married some Canaanite woman. The other, I believe, was married to an Egyptian. And since then, the tribes began to mix with some of the local inhabitants. After the Exodus, when the Jews and the Israelites conquered the land, and there were some wars between them and the Canaanites throughout the period, called period, read in the book of Judges, there was definitely a long period until it was significantly subdued by King David. By that time, most of the Canaanites were either married to Israelites, or others volunteered to accept and became Jews themselves, or joined amongst the Jews, or became into Jews. So they're basically absorbed. So most of the Canaanites actually absorbed into being Jews through mixture of marriage, conquer, you know, basically that's it. So the real Canaanites are basic that live there. You will only find them amongst Jews. Now there's only one other group other than the Canaanites, and you can look this by fact. That lived in there, they're called Druze. And their lineage, by the way, are lineage to going back to the time of Jethro. And even as his Druze who lived there, they will say that their forefather is Jethro. Now, Jethro is the father-in-law of Moses. If you know the story of Zipporah, she married, married to Moses. Therefore, the only people that can actually be traced to the ancient Canaanites are Jews, not Palestinians, as Canaanites did not exist any longer after that. After the 8th century BC, 8 century BC, they were gone, and now nothing existed. They're absorbed, period. That's 800 years before even Jesus. There were no Canaanites. They were gone. So the Palestinians cannot claim that they're descendants of ancient Canaanites. That's a fact. So if so, why not pretend also Syria is occupied territory or naming Lebanon? Why they do not speak the ancient language of the Canaanites that was actually Hebrew or a variation of, like the Phoenicians spoke? Because they are not Canaanites at all. In fact, the term Philistines, which is Palestinians, as which it was taken from, actually the Philistines and modern have something in common. Both are invaders from other lands. Because that's what that name means, to invade. In fact, the meaning of Palestinian, that there, it literally comes from the word Palashet, from the word Palesh, divider, perpetrator, or invaders. The Philistines were a confederation of peoples from Crete, in the Aegean Islands, Asian Minor, known as the Sea Peoples. This is a fact. Read it, and the Egyptians have tons of writings about that. The main tribes were, well, I'm not going to go into them. There are variations. The original homeland that ruled the Phoenician Federation, if you want to call it, namely the Pelasgi, was the island of Crete. And that's where they mainly lived. And then, of course, we all know the story. When they first they actually tried to live in Egypt. The Egyptians drove them out. They ended up started coming to, because they were invading Egypt all the time, attacking the Egyptians. And eventually they went to the Gaza area, and that's where they became. But they were defeated, by the way, by Ramses III in the 12th century BC. And the Philistines at the time started going up along the coast from Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Akron. And of course, they started attacking the Jews, which are, you know, that's how that whole thing started. King David, of course, subdued all of them, and that's what happened in that story. We know the whole story. The Philistines lost and were eventually gone. They were not Palestinians of today. Fact. They were basically gone. Gone. Driven out. No more. So, that's actually a fact. So there were no ancient people that they're claiming Palestinians. They were sent, these people who were born to the Arabs since the days of 67 were never true Canaanites. If they did, they would have continued speaking Hebrew, and they would demand from, for example, Syria to be, that's basically occupied from their homeland of Lebanon. But they're not. They're not really Philistines. Because Philistines, again, are from Crete. Originally from Greece. And I know this because I did research on it, writing a book about that area. Now, in the second century, of course, we all know the name was changed over. And this is how land became changed from Judea, which I mentioned. This is when the Romans finally, after the second temple and second revolt, as like to say, screw you to the Jews, started calling an area Palea, or Palestina, rather. It was actually just like, screw you to the Jews, right? Because they got to realize, Israel, the Jews in Judea, being 10% of the population, they are very close to sabotaging, and especially where they were located, greatly affect the Roman Empire. It was such a major, major event, so the Romans had to make an example. Because of that, because they were so scattered, and by the second revolt, which they actually almost won again, it was very close, that the Romans, that legions actually literally almost lost. There's some famous battles. You can read about them in Joseph Fabius' book called The Jewish Wars. He was actually a Roman historian, and you can read about it, and it's a fact. Anyway, so they changed the name Palestine, and a lot of Jews left, but then it wasn't like they all scattered to the wind and then it was empty. And then new one, there's nobody there. That's the fact. The name Philistine, that means you've been found, is not Arabic. It comes from Latin, Palestino. So how do Arab people have a Western name instead of their own language? Even the Caliph Saladin, everybody knows who he is, knew the Jews and kindly invited them to settle, to organize in Jerusalem and in that Judea or Israel. So there was a fact, there was a recognition that that area belonged to the Jews, even amongst Arab Muslims of that time under Saladin. Recognize that areas really have a Jewish origin. He just wanted to be rule over them, or whatever, a Muslim rule. But that was a fact. It was recognized. There's a famous historian, in fact, his name is Joseph Farah, quote, there has never been known as a Palestine, or by Palestinians. Palestinians are Arabs, or indistinguishable from another, which is another recent invention, Syrians or Iraqis. Another, keep in mind that Arabs controlled 99.9% of the Middle East, while Israel represented 1% of the landmass, but that too is for the Arabs. I mean, this is what Joseph Farah was explaining. There's a famous Syrian Arab leader at the British Peel Commission in 1937, Abu Bakr Abdul Hadi, and he said there is no such thing as Palestine. Palestine is the term that the Zionists created. There's no Palestine in the Bible. Our country for centuries is part of Syria. Palestine is alien to us. It is the Zionists introduced it. Get it? 1937. Somehow the Zionists introduced the name Zion of Palestine, which you'll find out how what that is. So there's no such thing as Palestine history. Absolutely not. This is by Professor Philip Hittiti, who was an Arab historian who wrote this in 1946. It's common knowledge that the Palestine is nothing more than southern Syria, said by Saadi, a representative or a diplomat in 1956 before the United Nations. Concerning the homeland and the Syrian delegation of the Peace Paris Peace Conference in 1919, say this: the only Arab domination since 1962-25 hardly lasted as much as 22 years. The only Arab domination since the conquest in 635 CE hardly lasted much such as 22 years. I mean, this is him saying it. He said Arabs, in fact, occupied Jerusalem and Judea almost like 22 years, essentially. Well, later became the Ottomans and then the other factions. I don't know if that's historically correct. But that's just his quotes. Now, there's other Arabs declared what they said after Six-Day War in the 67. And this is by Zuhar Mushin, who was the military commander of the PLO. And he was a member of the PLO Executive Council, and he said, there are no distinguished differences between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, Lebanese. We are all one nation. It is only for political reasons that we carefully underline our Palestinian identity. Yes, the existence of a separate Palestinian identity serves only one tactical purposes. The founding of a Palestinian state is a new tool to continue our battle against the Zionist entity Israel. Even Assad's father said, replied to Yasser Arafat, leader of the PLO, you do not represent Palestine as we do. Never forget this point. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. There was never a Palestinian identity. There is only Syria. You are an integral part of the Syrian people. Palestine is an integral part of Syria. Therefore, it is we, the Syrian authorities, who are the true representatives of the Palestinian people. As I lived in Palestine, this is a Palestinian Wali Shobut, and this is what he said, a Palestinian Arab said. Listen carefully when I say this. As I lived in Palestine, everyone I knew could trace their heritage back to the origin. Their country of origin, their grandparents from everywhere from their origin was not from the Canaanites, but ironic, this is the kind of our stuff, education in the Middle East included. The fact is that today's Palestinians are immigrants from the surrounding nations. I grew up well knowing the history and origins of today's Palestinians as being from Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Christians from Greece, Muslims, Shirkas from Russia, Muslims from Bosnia, and the Jordanians next door. My grandfather, who was a dignitary in Bethlehem, almost lost his life by Al-Hussein, the leader well known as the Mufti, after being accused of selling land to Jews. He used to tell us that the village Beit Sahir, known as the Shepherd Fields in the Bethlehem area, was empty. Empty. Before his father settled in there with six other families. The town has now grown into 30,000 inhabitants. Do you catch my drift? There were no people living there. Now I'll read you actual examples. And Mark Twain's Innocence Frog, 1867. There is not a solitary village throughout its whole extent, the Valley of Jezreel, the Galilee. But 30 miles in any direction, one may ride 10 miles, heartbeats, not see 10 human beings. For the sort of solitude make one dreary. Come to the Galilee, Nazareth at forlorn, Jericho lies in a moldering ruin. Bethlehem and Bethany is in their poverty, humiliation, untenanting by any living creature. A desolate country whose soul is rich enough but is given wholly to weeds, silent, mournful expanse, desolation. We never saw a human being on our route. Hardly a tree, a shrub, anywhere. Desolate. Unloving. 1867. No one lived there. You want to hear another person who wrote this? This is in 1590, a single English visitor wrote, "Nothing there is be seen but a little of old walls, which is yet remaining. All the rest is grass, moist weeds." This is found in a Palestinian exploitation, a Gunner's Web quarterly. In the 1700s, written by well-known British archaeologist Thomas Shaw, "The land in Palestine is lacking in people to till its soil." Constantine Francois, in the 15th century, wrote, and he's a famous historian, "Palestine is in ruin and desolate land." Common was also said, he concluded, "The Arabs themselves cannot be considered but temporary residents as they pitch their tents in gazing fields, built their places of virtue in ruined cities. They created nothing and made nothing. Since they were strangers to the land, they never became its masters. The desert wind that brought them there, hither could one dare carry them away without leaving behind any sign of their pasture throughout." 1844, this is written from Jaffa to Jerusalem by William Thackeray. "Then we entered the Till district." So you get to my drift. Basically, nobody's there. I can give a lane from James Finn of the Council of 1857, wrote, "Basically, the country is inhabitable, considerable inhabitants." You go on and on. 1892, same thing. I can read off reports. In 1913, even the British Royal Command said, basically it's like nobody lived there. Mostly it's there are Jews, and there are some Arabs. And basically, two populations moved there. In the 1800s. That's when there's a huge, as Jews moved, Arabs moved, as it is part of economics. I mean, besides, there are so much Arab sources. In 1985, the Arab writer Mugassi complained that in Jerusalem, the large majority, this is by the way, 985 CE, the Arab writer, Muslim, Mugaddasi complained that in Jerusalem, the large majority of the population were Jewish and said the mosque is empty of worshippers. Empty. This is 985. Ibn Khaldun, one of the most notable Arab historians in 1377, wrote, "The Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel extended over 1,400 years. It was the Jews who implanted the culture, the customs, and the permanent settlement." That was after 300 years of Muslim Arab rule in that land. Ibn attested the Jewish culture and tradition was still dominant. There was no evidence of Palestinian culture or roots, or even Arab significant roots. Now, here's for their real teaching and what they say in their book. This is in the Quran in 17:104, and this goes in the religious element. Now, this is going to be a long short because I'm going to extend into the other part, and they allowed me to continue on, which I will. In the Quran, it says, "And therefore we, Allah, said to the children, dwell in the promised land, and when the last warning will come to pass, we will gather you together in a mingled crowd." I mean, in the Quran, their own book talked about the Jews coming and moving and resettling back into Israel. Their own book. If they're real Muslims, real Muslims, R-E-A-L, there's always been a population. So the question of refugees and all that, Jerusalem being the holy city, it's never been really the holy city. There's questions of that. I mean, they didn't. There was never a presence. There were no mosques in Jerusalem in 1632. I mean, at the death of Jerusalem, it was basically a Christian city. Still, it was just occupied. And they put a flag, and that was it. You know the word Al-Quds, that you'll hear Arabs use the word Al-Quds. Do you know what Al-Quds means? Al-Quds means the Jewish temple. That's not retarded. Out of their own mouths, every time they say Al-Quds, it's such a joke. It means literally, it's abbreviation for the Jewish temple. That's right. The Arab name for Jerusalem is Al-Quds, the Holy, which is abbreviation for another Arab using the name under Bat al-Maqdis, means the Holy House. Since the 10th century CE, the name Bat al-Quds is a translation of Bet al-Maqdish, which is just Arab version of Bet al-Maqdish, which is the House of Holies, which the Jews call the temple, Bet al-Maqdish and Bet al-Maqdis. So it comes from the word temple, because but the Islam, there has no temple. Only Jews have a temple there. The Arabic name for Jerusalem makes no rest, even a reference to Muhammad supposedly going there to that area. In fact, there's actually nothing that says that he actually went to Jerusalem. Nothing. It's not a thing said Jerusalem, that he went to Jerusalem. Mecca is the holy city to the Muslims, just as Jerusalem is the holy city to the Jews. That is the fact. This is even said by an Arab biographer, Yahud, who knows in the 13th century Rome. It has been their eternal capital. And they can't continue making revisions on history. It is a fact. Everybody knows. Even Jerusalem, the word Jerusalem is Hebrew. Literally means God's city of peace. Yerushalayim. Ya'ir, God's city, Shalom, peace. So now, modern. Where do we go from here? Let's go back in time in the 19th. Got to realize when up to the 1800s, nobody was living there. And then two populated movement came, and two populations based first, a lot of Jews moved, and Arabs are moving into that area out of economics. It was normal. Think about it. You open a factory, you grew some things, Jews, Arabs brought merchandise. I mean, there was a colligarium of things, you know, different things. I knew for a fact because I remember. Friends of mine, even Kafarkara and Tukaram, I talked to them, and they laugh. I says, "Where's your family from?" Oh, they, and this is back in the 1980s, and I said, "Well, my father's from here. My grandfather's from Syria." Everyone kept on telling Damascus, Syria. My best friend, who's one of the major families in that area, he said his grandfather, and I met his father, and his father is like totally looks Syrian, wears the white kafir and everything, very Syrian like, and admitted there's, and he said he's there from Damascus. And they moved there out of economics because they were poor, and they came out there because they knew Jews had just moved out into that area, especially near the Haifa northern area, especially the Carmel was being turned into a wineries, and you know there's work, labor. People come there for work. It's like anything. Go there where there's work, like any people. And they themselves form their own things. And of course, if people go, oh, there was Jaffa oranges. Yeah, come on, really. That was down in the south, and there wasn't that much. And it, that was a population move there when? In the 1800s. Okay? So that they too. They made their thing. Everybody came there, but they weren't original there. Not like people keep on making Palestinians like they were the Native Americans. They're in the, like, they're like the Native Americans. They're the Indians of that area. Bullshit. Now here's the real important information. Starts with a story called King Hajjaz. His name is Hussein bin Ali. Look him up. Who was this guy? Who was King Hajjaz? He was the one who made the agreement with the Brits to fight off the Ottomans. Of course, he did it mainly on his own with his group of Arab forces. Who was King Hajjaz? He was the father of King Abdullah I, who became the King of Jordan, who later, his other son, Amir, the Amir, later became, who names Faisal, who later became the king of Iraq. Of course, he was in Syria and kicked out of Syria because he was supposed to be the king of Syria, but then they gave him Iraq. The English did. The Brits gave him this. The Brits gave King Abdullah Jordan. And of course, King Abdullah the First is the father of King Hussein of Jordan, who's the great grandfather of today's king, King Abdullah the Second. King Hajjaz was the true caliph of Mecca, and was the one who was instrumental against the revolt against the Ottomans in removing them. But after they won, after World War I was over, the Brits and the French formed what they called the Hussein-McMahon Agreement, giving the Arabs their country in 1916. This, there was not to be a Jordan, Syria, or Lebanon, in fact. Those were going to be provinces. Sort of like regions or states. That's how it was set up. This is a fact. And you can look it up, the Hussein-McMahon Agreement, 1916. Now, because they had control from that whole area, from Syria all the way to Arabia, under King Hajjaz, under that terms of understanding, he was approached with Amir as his son. Amir approach with Chaim Weizmann under the agreement of Hajjaz, whose Chaim Weizmann was the head of the Zionist movement in 1919, whereby the Jews would have their own country borders, respecting the residents there and allowing the Muslims to control their only the Muslim holy places, like the Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem, of course, the temple. Like Jews, Israel does today, they let the Muslims run their own mosque. And they confirmed, this is really important, the Balfour Declaration, creating the homeland for the future country for the Jews. See, the idea was the Jews would have their country of Israel, and King Hajjaz would have his country with provinces. He didn't really want to run, but he wanted to form a confederation later on, almost like the EU. Israel would have its own country, and then he'd control the others, and there was forming a... That was the idea. Unfortunately, that didn't really fit into the plan of the British petroleum products, or the Brits. In 1919, the Saadi family were from Riyadh, attacked the Hashemites, and King Hajjaz was a Hashemite, of course. Hashemites controlled. In fact, Hajjaz is the lineage of Muhammad. That is a fact. He was actually, and the campaign, by the way, lasted for 5 years, but the Brits were certainly behind us. They wanted to remove King Hejaz, which removed his little idea of major Arabia. Arabia was going to include Syria, Lebanon, Jordan. There was nothing of that. It was never carved out. That was it. It was provinces. They didn't even have... The only province name they had is actually Syria at that time. I think they had another name for the Jordan area. But if you looked on the map, the land that they were giving to the Jews, by the way, is just east of the Jordan River. East of the Jordan. It's like on the other side of the Jordan. Not the west. East of the Jordan. Included the Gaza Strip area of today. Included... I'd say about two-thirds of what today's Golan Heights, and actually 10 miles north of today's modern border with Lebanon. And Jerusalem would be under Jewish control. Only the Muslim places would be respected in a Muslim watch. That's a fact. You can read it. So, Brits basically trashed any agreement, prior agreements made between Hejaz and the Jews. Why? Oil. What's going on in the Middle East even today? The power of oil. He who controls oil controls energy, is the major power. Very important, that thing called oil, those three-letter word. So instead, in 1920, April 19th through 26th, there was a major conference held in San Remo, well known as the San Remo Conference. An agreement was signed and made by all allied powers, including the UK, France, who basically ran the show while the US observed. Agreement was reached as follows. I read. France would control Syria, later we'd be partitioning it, making Lebanon. Iraq would come under control under the UK, which was to be carved out and later ruled by King Faisal. King Hejaz's son would be received Transjordan, later to be called Jordan, to King Abdullah. Of course, what happened to Hejaz? He was exiled. Under the Brits' control to help formulate the Jews, develop the future homeland as follows. And I read, this is what it said in the San Remo Agreement. The high country parties agree that Syria and Mesopotamia, they didn't have a word for Iraq, by the way, at that time, show accordance with 4th Article 22, Part 1, Covenant of League of Nations. That means because it was going to be, it was ratified by the League of Nations, be provisionally recognized as independent states, subject to the rendering of administrative advice, means the British to have influence, or French, ascendance by a mandatory until such time as they stand alone, meaning we'll help you along until you're now an independent country. The boundaries of said assets will be determined in the selection of mandatory spread made by the principal allied powers. The high conquering parties agreed to entrust by application of the provisions of Article 22, this is really important, the administration of Palestine within such borders as may be determined by the principal allied powers to a mandatory to be selected by the said powers. The mandatory will be responsible for putting into effect the declaration made on November 8, 1970 by the British government, adopted by all other allied powers in favor of establishment a Palestine national homeland for the Jewish people. It being clear, understood that nothing does prioritize the civil and religious rights of the non-Jewish communities. I mean, don't subject to the non-Jews living there, or the rights political sovereignty enjoyed by Jews in any other country, meaning if Jews live in other countries, they would not lose their rights for the living just because there's a country over there. This was ratified by the League of Nations. They have signed off this, as it is called the San Remo, and is why they received Jordan and Iraq. It was carved out. And Syria. And then also later Lebanon. That's right. Under the League of Nations, Israel was to be created. The borders were to be from Jordan River to the Golan Heights, included Jerusalem and the West Bank. The UN, by its charter, ratified all prior agreements held by the League. That's a fact. Thus, the West Bank legally is not occupied land, but held under the Israel per San Remo Agreement, Section 22. The San Remo Agreement was implemented under the Treaty of Lausanne, signed in 1924. This established the created illegal borders. Now, what happened after this? In the early 1920s, the Brits, brought in Amin al-Husseini, known later as the Mufti of Jerusalem, even against the wish of the Arab populace. Why? What do you think? Now first, who is Amin al-Husseini? Well, let's get a little history. He is, by the way, the first Palestinian leader, if you want to call him that. He was also uncle of Yasser Arafat. Haha, link. You'll think of why things are today. In 1914, Amin al-Husseini swears allegiance to the Ottoman Empire during the Armenian Genocide. He is, in fact, an officer stationed in Smyrna and participated firsthand in the Armenian Genocide. Gee, wonder why the Arabs don't like to talk about the Armenian Genocide or today's modern there, because they were part of it. Where some 1.5 million Christian Armenians were murdered. The El-Hussein Mufti participated in these murders. With the helps of the Brits, Amin al-Husseini returned to the Palestine Mandate. And what did he bring with him? His lessons and understandings of genocide and his vision of a pan-Islamic empire. He was no friend of Jew or Christian, far from it. In 1921, the British, against the local Muslim vote. They had actually a little election, by the way. They actually superseded. They appointed Al-Humayn Hussein as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Al-Humayn Mini came in fourth place in the vote. The Muslim community rejected his candidacy, not only because they didn't like him, because he had no education. He didn't even know have any. He's Mr. Muslim. He had no Islamic education. He was neither a sheikh, which is a religious accredited leader, nor an al-alim, an Islamic scholar. How can somebody be the head, be a mufti, and have, it's like being, not reading anything of the Bible and becoming the head of their organized religion? Didn't make any sense. He becomes a preeminent Arab power in Palestine. Mandate. His brutality became notorious, not amongst only Jews, but also amongst Muslims as well. He implements restoration of the gold, the Dome of the Rock. By the way, there was no gold-plated dome before 1928. That's when he, or in the 1920s, that's when he initiated it. The Muslims didn't give a flying F about Al-Aqsa. In 1928, El-Humayni, the Mufti, became the central leading member in the Muslim Brotherhood. Oh, you know about Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? Yep, he was the head, one of the heads. In the 1920s, he organized riots against Jews, no different than what the Nazis did in the early 1930s. In 1929, Hebron was a Jewish city, yet he organized the massacre of the Jews there. What did the Brits do? Nothing. In the 1930s, he led riots in Jerusalem, leading murders of Jews throughout. Again, what did the Brits do? Nothing. In 1937, the Mufti and Eichmann and other SS infamous Nazis met in the German consul. And in 1931, the Mufti allies with Hitler. His reaches, by the way, weren't just in Israel. He tried to help the Nazis in Iraq with an attempted coup over the kingship. In 1941, the Mufti meets Hitler in Berlin. In 1941, the Mufti al-Husseini creates the Muslim Arab, if you want to call them Palestine, SS in Bulgaria under the direction of Himmler. This group killed 22,000 Jews, 200,000 Christian Serbs, 40,000 Gypsies in Bulgaria. Oh, yeah. The Arabs there says, oh, we didn't have nothing to do. We had nothing to do. We had nothing to do with what happened in the Holocaust. Yeah, that's right. Their leader did, huh? You guys didn't? Bullshit. He later creates the Hunza Division, a Muslim pure race, as he called it, in 1943. In 1943, Hitler bestowed unto him prime minister of pan-Arabs, meaning he was supposed to be the leader of all Arabs. In 1944, Amin al-Husseini Mahdi makes a famous speech to his Muslim SS. Kill Jews wherever you find them. Gee, this same thing, by the way, can be held, you can heard in the recent, of many imams in mosques of today. How sickening. They call themselves of God, of Allah. Bullshit. We'll talk about next week. In 1948, with the UN recognition, Israel declares statehood. Arab League immediately declares jihad against Israel. Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Jordan immediately declare war on the New Jersey, along with all Arab nations, and invade Israel. Amin al-Husseini declared, I declare a holy war. My brother murdered the Jews, murder them all. Politics of hate were brought in by the Brits. The Brits had an agenda to bring a Husseini Mahdi. It was obvious why. Hate, divide, and conquer. The U.S. was allied with the Brits. Of course, you know that. In 1947, the attack began. John Bagot Glove, the elite British officer who was the commander of the Arab Legion from 1939 to 1946. A British officer, again I repeat, John Bagot Glove was head of the Arab Legion from 1939 to 1956. This British officer elite, John Bagot Glove, orchestrated and led the attempted destruction not only of the state of Israel, but the final solution, murder of all Jews in Israel. And what did he get from the Queen of England? A knighthood, yes. He was knighted. So those idiots who call this nonsense about Zionists being the queen and the Umadi crap is pure bullshit. This is the same bullshit that David Icke, who's nothing more than another Husseini Mahdi idiot, nut jobs, is pure bullshit. They have their own agenda. They hate Jews. They hate Israel. Stick that little star, David. They hate it. There's nothing around it. The Queen, UK, wanted to destroy Israel. Why? It was screwing up their plan. They had themselves a nice little thing going called oil. You see, they had controlled the oil fields in Iraq, in Turkur. And they had this little railroad line that ran all the way. You could see it if you go up to Golan. It's still part. I hope it's still there. I saw it, remember, back in the 80s. That ran all the way through Damascus and all the way to Haifa. Get it? It was oil. The politics of the Middle East has been and is now and will always be oil. Now, some people think, oh, the U.S. was friends with Israel. No, they weren't. Israel, the U.S. actually had an arms embargo that lasted from 1948 to 67 against Israel. In fact, the United States of America had a naval blockade against Israel from 1947 through 48. The Soviets were the ones who backed Israel from 1947 to 1953. They're the ones who supplied arms and for Israel. This is a fact. The Soviet Union, USSR, were the ones who were instrumental backing arms who supported Israel. Not the United States of America, not the Brits, not the French. It was the Soviet Union. Now, there was a major 180 switch. Nasser overthrew the kingship of Egypt, and that made a switch. Now, who was Nasser? He was from the Muslim Brotherhood. Get it? Muslim Brotherhood. He was one of the heads of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they took control of Egypt, and they switched, meaning switch alliances. Because when he seized the Suez Canal, of course, the Soviets like that, because guess what? Soviets would back anything that was anti-British or anti-West. Suddenly, they were under the Soviet influence, and they developed their Fedayeen campaigns against Israel immediately. And who was one of the head coordinators of that? Egyptian Yasser Arafat, the nephew of Hussein. By the way, Yasser Arafat was not born or raised in Israel. He was from Egypt. He went there just for a couple of years. After the seizure of the Suez by Nasser, Brits, French, and Israel, continued terrorists by Yasser Arafat's Egyptian Fedayeen attack, they, of course, Israel attacked. And with coordination with the Brits and French took control of both the Sinai and the Suez. But Eisenhower threatened Israel. Oh, yeah. They were threatened to return. But Nasser, under the agreement, promised to allow Israel access to the Suez. In the 1960s, Israel had a very, very close relation. In fact, through this relationship, Israel was able to get uranium and develop their own new capability. Of course, this set off the Soviets. Thus, the Soviets devised a plan to attack Israel. The United States had no idea, nor the Brits or the French. Israel's Mossad discovered it. This was confirmed by the KGB years later after the end of the USSR. Fact. This is what became the Six-Day War. Israel, of course, won, gaining the West Bank back, because it was legally under the terms of the mandate theirs, not occupied, and Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, and Gaza. During this campaign, the U.S., by the way, sent the most sophisticated spy ship of its time, the USSS Liberty. What for? The U.S. was not an ally of Israel. Far from it. They still had in place an arms embargo against it. And let's see, the USSA was, since the end of World War II, were really tight with some family called the Saudi family. Why? Oh, yeah, oil. So, the Liberty was not just an innocent bystander. Oh, the little tot ship that flew into the area. The Liberty was a sophisticated spy ship spying on Israeli military movements in a theater of war. And they were sending this military intelligence to Saudis. That is a fact. The Liberty was in a combat zone where a war was active. They weren't some Bambi in the woods. They were carrying out a military intelligence operation against Israel, transferring this intelligence to Israel's enemy, Saudis, who in fact could easily have sent the same intelligence to Jordan, thus affect the outcome of the war and affect Israeli soldiers' lives. Israel had every right to take care of the Liberty. So when I hear this, poor me, pity crap Liberty personnel today, please ask this one simple question to any of them. They can't answer it. Why were you gathering military information on the Israeli military movements and dispatching them to the Saudis? Gee, wonder why this was all hushed up? Now here's a fact. The U.S. was not allies of Israel before the war or during the war. In fact, they were going to had intentions of attacking Israel. This is a fact. Here from the Haaretz, April 23rd, 2003, was well disclosed. For the some time, the United States had an emergency plan to attack Israel, a plan updated just prior to the 60th of Arm, aiming at preventing Israel from expanding westward into the Sinai or eastward to the West Bank. This can be found in the article I had just aforementioned. It was after 1967, the Six-Day War, that the U.S. did a 180 about face and realized, uh-oh, Israel can be a deterrent against the Soviets. This is where there was a major change. People consistently today leave out the little games that were going on between British oil and the Soviet versus the U.S. and British West game board, you call it. Anyway, the whole damn Mideast was one puppet-playing game between the Soviets and the U.S. / Brits from then on. In fact, it was the Soviets who created the idea, by the way, of the Palestinian state. Yes, read it. Soviets had very brilliant propagandists of manipulating things. That was all. They had a special unit of doing propaganda. They call it the Political Bureau. In fact, it was the Soviet Union, the USSR, that created the PLO. That is a fact. They funded and trained the PLO. They helped carry Yasser Arafat. Gee, ever wondered why Yasser Arafat was in Moscow so much? And now here we are. Most, which I'm going to get into the next show, which gets more into some spiritual realities. But most don't know the true facts, like the Shiite versus Sunni conflict that has been there since the time of Muhammad's death. Who is to be the leader? Ali? This has been a thousand-year-old conflict of who should rule Mecca. The present Iran and Syria conflict, the Sunni versus Shiite, and then the Lebanon and all about religion, has never been about land. The conflict of Arabs versus Jews was started by the Brits. Why? Over getting a whole lot of oil. And what did the Brits do? They threw a whole lot of oil with a little match. And it's been going on since. And this has been going on and on. Now, here's the other fact. Before Bush Clinton pushed down the Oslo, down the Israelis throat, the Oslo Accord, who were the Palestinians in the mandate? How were they really doing? How were the Palestinians in the West Bank doing? The fact is, they should be asking themselves, were they better before Oslo Accord or after? You know that old question. Well, here is a fact. In the 80s, they were Jordanian citizens. There were Jordanian citizens in 1980 until King Hussein unilaterally removed it. In fact, the average Palestinian in the West Bank lived a better than average American. I know this firsthand. I saw it in Tucumán, in Nablus, in Ramallah. I'm telling you, they had cash. They had lots of cash. They were buying BMWs, not for $25,000, for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. Okay, I'm just telling you. $60,000 cash. How many Americans have $60,000 cash? Buying Mercedes, buying BMWs. They were buying even Peugeots for $30,000. I mean, they bought cars with cash. They didn't have credit cards. They didn't have monthly payments. Cash. They built their villas in cash. They didn't have credit cards. You think they ran around in the West Bank with little credit cards? They didn't have that. They didn't have ATM cards. They had cash. Everything was cash. They used to have so much, and I saw, I'm just telling you, I saw it firsthand. I can't explain how or why or what. I'm telling you, they used to stick not hundreds of dollars in trousseau floors, thousands of dollars in the trousseau floors. They had the trousseau floors there, like cut tiles, and they pull them up and they used to stick them in there. I saw that. I'm telling you. It's all that you know. Then in 1988, of course, Jordan withdrew their decision, thus initiating the real reason behind the FIDEA. That's right, 1988 was, think about it, you lose your citizen, you're in void. But they actually thought, they had thought that Israel was going to finally annex the West Bank and they were going to become Israeli citizens. That's actually what the Arabs in the West Bank wanted. They wanted to be Israeli. If they were Jordanian citizen, okay, we'll be Israeli. Because they knew the benefits of being Israeli because of what the benefits Israeli Arabs were getting. Telling you, the Israeli Arabs were living quite well, and they loved it. You think any Israeli Arab would want to be move into under a Palestinian state? Hell no. See, at the same time, George Bush Sr., by the way, was pushing Shamir, then Prime Minister of Israel, to the conference road. This, of course, led to the Oslo. Now, let me ask you this. What became of Oslo? Since then, how many thousands of Jews and Arabs have killed? Well, thousands of Israelis and the Palestinians dead. How many? What became? And tell me this. What did the PA do? All they did was teach their children and the Palestinians. Did they teach them to be peace? Did they teach the children and the Palestinians, yes, this is what we need to do. We're going to peace agreement in Israel with the Jews. Should we try to show how we can, you know, whatever? No, they didn't. 2000, literally less than 7 years after the signing of Oslo, they start another infidia, a bloody, bloody situation. They killed Jews wherever you can find them. You shall die as a martyr, killing their children. I'm reading off what their statements are. And this, by the way, they're still saying. This was said then, some 12 years ago, 15 years ago, 17 years ago. Oh, El Hussein said it. They're still saying it. All I can say, if one teaches hate to their children, then it is only they themselves responsible and blamed for the inevitable death and violence to their own children. They're honorable victims. They're only volunteers. So before there will ever be peace, it will take educating a generation, perhaps generations, of educating them into peace. Perhaps two generations. But in the present situation, there is a simple plan for peace. Besides re-educating, Israel and Jordan jointly controlling the West Bank. All the Palestinians in the West Bank immediately get their Jordanian citizenship. What's so weird about that? The heir to Jordan is Palestinian. The wife of King Abdullah II, the queen of Jordan, Palestinian. It is a Palestine. As King Hussein had said, Jordan is Palestine, Palestine is Jordan. Simple. And make growing control of the West Bank and we're done. Everybody goes home. And educate non-hate. The residents of Gaza become Egyptian. Period. Egypt and Exodus Gaza. My wait. Do it already. What are we waiting for? Last thing, everybody wondered, what about the Palestinian refugees in the so-called... real easy. They're immediately absorbed into their host countries, mandated by the UN. Lebanon, wherever you are, I don't care where they are, you absorb them. Tough shit. All Jews and their heirs to receive immediate compensation. That means all Jews and their heirs to receive compensation for lost property from the expulsion from Arab Muslim countries. All refugees, including the Palestinians and Jews, receive compensation. The UN certainly can fit the bill for both. We're done. And that's it. So, for now, for the spiritual reality of the Middle East, I'll get into that next week. And that will be for my next show on June 8th. I want to thank you all for listening. And with that, I think it's easy to say some things and some things go adrift. But I will close with a cool song. And I think it's only appropriate for all those to listen, including those in the Middle East. This is, of course, by Rage Against the Machine. And it is what it is.
They use force to make you do what the disciples have decided you must do.
God bless y'all and have a great and glorious weekend.
They use force to make you do what the disciples have decided you must do. They use force to make you do what the disciples have decided you must do. Do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. all the things that burn across us! Do what you tell me! Fuck you all! Do what you tell me! Fuck you all!